and series have been careful to caution and to warn the families that are in the body of Christ to be different. All right? And that's what I'm going to aim at this evening. We'll return to this lesson again in one other part. Just as I will talk about our relationship with government, we're not going to do this as a complete or straight series. We're going to take sections of it and we're going to talk about it just as we'll talk about these other matters. But what I want to set forth this evening is nothing new, of course. Something you've heard before. Maybe you've heard it exactly the way I've said it. Maybe you've heard it even better, and that's all right. But we need to be warned again. And it's more than a prophetic word, look what's coming. This is what's going to happen. This is what our children are going to face. This is what our grandchildren are going to face. We talk like that, and it may very well be. But I can't do nothing about that, and neither can you. I mean, as far as it occurring. I think we get the impression we're going to stop something. We're going to end something. It's going to just be reset. And that if we just do certain things, like we said with the discussion of our relationship with the government, we get this impression if we just get that next good moral official elected, be it the governor, our representative, the president, we may stave off some dangers for the time being. We may look like we're resetting, but we may be only delaying the inevitable. I have said this before, and I will repeat it again, and I have done this throughout my opportunities to stand before audience since I could remember. The greatest sin that we've ever committed as a nation, above all others, and I'm not saying that we have not done great, terrible things, but the greatest sin as a society we've ever had is to killing the unborn, the innocent, the absolute innocent. And there's been great sins. We've had great tragedies since the beginning of this nation. We've had travesties and tragedies and terrible things done upon humanity of all kinds. Between slavery and between wars and various other things we have done some terrible things, even as a nation with the freedoms that we have and the liberties that we enjoy. However, I am assured that God will punish us for the killing of the innocent. When and how, I cannot tell. I wouldn't know. But does that really matter? Really? Does it really matter if it happens in my lifetime or in my children's or grandchildren? Absolutely not. So what I set forth this evening is rather a pattern of discussion. Though I have a great audience here that is mostly grandparents for the most part, we certainly can have an effect. For those of us who are parents with children at home, even those who have younger children, this lesson is as important to you as any. Because you're not going to change society. We talk of the village. I don't know how many times since I've been grown. Really wasn't much of a discussion all the way through my childhood, teenage, high school years, and adulthood. I think somewhere about the 90s. It probably didn't start there. But all of a sudden, everybody talked about taking a village. It's going to take a village. It's going to take a village to create a better society. It takes a village to mold and shape the child. That is the lie of the devil, I assure you. But it is not biblical. There's not a biblical principle anywhere near that. We're not going to save society by communities. We're not going to save the society by governments. We're not going to save the society by any collective. The society, if there's any hope for it, will be in the family. That's what the Bible teaches, in the family. Today's families are in trouble. Sure, the society's in trouble. Sure, the community's in trouble. Sure, the nation's in trouble. But all of that's true only because the family's in trouble. Does the government have a part to play in it? Sure, they've done a lot of damage. Don't individuals, don't other collectives and groups and interest groups have a part to play in the damage? Sure, they do. I'm not arguing that people have not inflicted terrible things upon through education, be it formal or otherwise. I'm not arguing that. But all of that, all that ultimately lies at the doorstep, lies at the doorstep of the family. You see a little bit of that if you pay attention to the news. I watch some, maybe not as much as some or as many, But I only get my bits and pieces, and on purpose. For one, it's too much tragedy for me to pay attention to. Really, number one, I got too much other things to do that keep me very busy, and I'm glad for that. More important things, I would argue. However, I do pay attention to what's going on, so I know what's going on. Not so much for gossip's sake or for conversational pieces, but just so I get the tone of things that I'm going to be experiencing or get an idea of what I may come to experience. And you know, one of the most prominent themes that has happened, especially in the period between the pandemic and 2020 up to this point, has been the ideal of the education system and what's being purported as history and so on and so forth. I don't want to get into all those discussions. The main thing is that families have discovered, parents have discovered, they don't have a say, generally speaking. No surprise. They didn't have it back in the day, but they didn't care because it was not an interest in it. Now that there is a new envelope being pushed even further out and destroying and eroding things that parents do not care for, such as segregating little children and teaching them to hate themselves and those sorts of things. Since that has started, parents have woke up and said, hey, only problem is it may be a little too late because it comes out of a generation that was taught even after mine. You see, the teachers and the leaders, a little dating of myself, as young as I may be, the majority of these, they came a decade behind me. The majority of the people in leadership roles in the school systems and in the boards of education and in the NEA, etc., as a general rule, are at least 10 years younger than I am. And yet, again, the problem ultimately lies at the doors of the family. Now, what will the family do about it? That's important. And that's what we want to establish this evening. First of all, Genesis 2. Genesis 2 lays out the very simple rule that God desired a man and a woman to gather to get, come together and to be married. That's really, that's what we learn by the story of Adam and Eve. That no, it is not an option to decide how you're going to lay out the family. You can't social engineer. You don't have an option. You don't have an option to have two of the same sex marrying one another. Besides the biological impossibility of procreating, it just doesn't work because God says it will not because that's not how He's designed it. Period. All right? But see, more than that, I want you to be impressed with this. And I've said this before in one way or the other. What is the greatest earthly institution? I know what the greatest spiritual institution is. It's the Lord's kingdom, His church. And we can't escape that. We might try to, but the fact is, it's the greatest spiritual institution in which all of us are going to stand before that throne someday, and we're going to give an answer as to whether or not we participated in that kingdom according to God's scheme. If we have subjected ourselves to that, submitted ourselves to that king, and we've done that well, we'll hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant. If we have not, then he will say, hey, I do not know you. You're not a part of this kingdom. You're not a citizen in this kingdom. Go into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. You'll be cast us there. That I know. It should not surprise us that in the scheme of things, as God records for us, He doesn't even establish world government until chapter 14. We don't read about it. I'm not saying it started on that chapter. But the first time you discover that men got together collectively and appoint themselves leaders, whatever, however they did that, we don't discover it until chapter 14. And how do we discover it? We discover it in the form of what? War. No shock there either. Chapter 14, we got five kings of the east going up, four kings against the west, and of course the four kings of the east are the five kings of the west, and it is the four kings that overpower the five. And of course, Sodom is already taken captive because they lost that battle as part of the five kings of the east, west. But they weren't any better off, were they? They were a wicked and a vile city, and most of the cities of the plains were in the same boat. And by the way, God sent Abraham to a land in which there were plenty of wickedness going on. So there was no good peoples. So let that be a lesson about governments when we return to that. When God established government, all we see is tragedy. When He says He establishes it, and we talked about it from Romans 13, and it's necessary according to God's scheme. Do not think that I'm saying it's righteous by itself, in and of itself altogether. I didn't teach that, and I won't. But it is established by God. But I want to get back to the subject. The earthly institution that is the greatest value of which God wants governed well, that really will have an impact on society, greater than any government, greater than any collective, greater than any organization, greater than any than nonprofits or anything of that nature, cultural or otherwise, is the family. Notice chapter 2 and verse 24. For this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Long before there were governments, God established a man and woman to gather together. We will discover that they will have children by chapter 4. Yes, there's terrible things happen even into adult children, but they will continue to have children. And again, God will have those that will serve him, as we've already discovered, in men like Seth and the men of his generation, or of his son's generation. For it says in Genesis 4 and verse 26, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. And then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. In chapter 5, we learn that there was a man named Enoch. Enoch had lived, in verse 21, for 65 years, and he became the father of Methuselah. But then Enoch, it says in verse 22, walked with God 300 years. Guys, that's a remarkable number of years, isn't it? Man had a long time. We say on one hand, man had plenty of time to serve God, and they didn't always do. So even if God gave you more time, it doesn't mean you'll do anything better. But we do notice that this man walked with God for 300 years. Wonderful story. So we find righteousness even into Noah, despite the fact that we see the vast majority of the human race wicked. Obviously, there was poor parentage along the way as well. We cannot ever escape that. It's not just the individual. Yes, the individual is accountable. And yes, the parents are ultimately can only do so much. And eventually, the individual will be accountable to God. As Ezekiel will tell us in Ezekiel chapter 18, that the father is not responsible for the son's sin, nor the sons for the father's. And while that may be so, we still know that the prominent problem in society isn't society. The prominent problem in society isn't government. The prominent problem in society isn't the coalitions and the various interests of the special kinds. It's the family. And I don't care what sociologists and psychiatrists and psychologists and marriage counselors and family counselors, whatever they affirm, even those that will affirm that, oh, we need good families, they always arrive at it in the wrong way. Because God has the perfect way, and we need to pay attention to it. Again, the home is the foundation of society. Let me repeat that again. The home, the family, is the only real foundation of any society, no matter what. And God, man cannot improve upon God's way. Notice with me in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34. First, the Proverbs have many things to teach us in respect to our responsibility as parents and our responsibilities as children as well. But Proverbs 14 and verse 34 says plainly, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. But dear friends, I ask you the question, how does righteousness beget a nation? That's what our option, that's what our desire or design will be this evening. How does righteousness exalt a nation? We can say that generically, and someone might just start at the top and start saying, we just get the right presidents. We get the right representatives. We get the right judges. We're always worried about Supreme Court justices, aren't we? We get all of that. We get our ducks in the row. We get enough states just right, and a righteousness will prevail, and therefore then there will be no disgrace. But I'm going to submit to you this evening, the righteousness that exalts a nation starts in the home. How can we use our homes? I'm talking to us that are Christians. How can we use our homes in order to help a nation be much better, for a greater society in general? That's our objective. Number one, Christian homes. They should be the influencer societies and not the other way around. But you know what it always seems to be? the society influences us. They tell us what we're going to do with our children, what we're going to do. And you know, we let them. We've told them. And that's why I said there's this rise in concerns in a coalition of families and parents all over this nation going to these school board meetings. I won't say a little too late, though it could be. Because this didn't happen yesterday. It didn't happen in the last 2 or 3 years. The things that are going on started way back there. And we saw the gradual decline. We saw a little bit of taste of it, no doubt, in my generation, though very not as much as you saw it in the next, and then eventually in the next, until we have gotten here. We've given authority over to an institution, and we're not allowed for our responsibility. We do that in part because we're materialistic. Let's just be honest. It's not like we can just lay all the blame. The reason is we're just as materialistic as the rest of them. We want, and we get, and we enjoy. We're worried about ourselves. We're selfish people. We neglect because we're so wrapped up in ourselves. We show no respect for God's design of the family, nor we see our responsibilities. If we do it all, we see it as the responsibility to provide. But I'm also going to stress one other thing that we're going to see in this lesson as well. Fathers, mothers included, but fathers particular, your first objective isn't the providing for your family like you've been told throughout the years. Your job isn't to go to work to provide for your family. That's an expectation. You notice the Bible actually doesn't so much command that as it's already a given expectation in part. But on the other hand, there's very explicit and direct directions in order for you or I to raise our children or train them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And Proverbs are full of those kinds of admonitions. Teaching, strengthening, etc. The Christian home should be the one that makes the choices for society and not the other way around. Notice with me in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10. Notice what Paul says when he's with the Thessalonians. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. Some would look at that and say, well, there you have it. Preacher, didn't you just tell me that it's not the job of the father to provide for his family? Doesn't say anything about that there. It does talk about the eating, but what is the design? What is the point? You see, they live in a totalitarian state and have been. There is no such thing as democracy in these days. So Paul's not talking about that. And they don't live in the greatest and the richest society anyway. In fact, there's no social welfare systems. There's lazy people, yes. There are people in that condition. But I'll tell you what, it's a very vulnerable time. What is Paul's argument? You've got a responsibility to show society how it's done. You've got a responsibility to show society what is good because you're not neglecting these opportunities. You're not neglecting your responsibilities. The same is true in Ephesians 4:28 when he says, you work so that you do not steal. That's the point of Ephesians 4:28. What's the point of telling them eat and work and so that you have something to provide for others and not stealing? Because that was the only other thing that people would do in the society. Because again, there was no government handout. There wasn't a dole. You weren't going to sit around and collect a check. You were going to work or you're going to starve. And if you didn't starve, you were going to steal. And they had plenty of thieves. And so the counsel is thus. You are a Christian. You don't do these things. You inform society how it is done. And by the way, the working oftentimes will be very difficult and maybe even cruel. There's no labor unions. You think 19th century America was a bad place to work? Move into the first century Palestine, first century Roman Empire, and you will know what real work is. And you will understand really a day's wage. The point of these texts that we oftentimes look at and make some broad applications in the 20th and 21st century has very specific dynamic. And he says that a Christian is one who stands up in society and does what he needs to do to take care of those whom he loves. And he shows the rest of society around him what to do. Because there are many people who say, well, I wouldn't work for him. We do that nowadays. There may come a time which there won't be that option anymore. No, they showed that we do because we work unto the Lord, you see. We work with our hands even to the Lord. Go back to Genesis chapter 3. If you don't think this is a principle that God set out for society, for men and women, or men as the heads of the house, of course, but as family units, to show even those who would be derelict, then you miss the point. Genesis chapter 3, in verse 19. Of course, we see in the scene that there is a punishment here, and the land is not going to produce what it will. Later on in chapter 6, interesting enough, Lamech will say that in the previous days, it was this way, but in my father's days, it is much better. We'll talk about that in a moment. But verse 19, by the sweat of your face, you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. We only look at that generally to look at, wow, if we do bad, see what will happen to us. That's all we do, right? Well, let's go over to Genesis 6 and see a change. We'll see a change. I say Genesis 6, Genesis 5, sorry. In Genesis 5, there was a man named Lamech, verse 28, who lived 182 years and became a father of a son. Then now he called his name Noah, saying, notice, Lamech, the father of Noah, says, this one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord had cursed. Have you ever saw that? Did you notice that? See, a lot of us just assume that the cursing of the ground in chapter 3 is one of those implications all the way to the down. But now we got such great science, if you will, technologies. We become the breadbasket of the world. If we so choose, we can grow much more on less soil, etc. How would that even apply? I'll be honest with you, I don't know many farmers that sweat anymore. And I'm not trying to be mean to farmers as a general rule. I'm just saying there's so much modern machinery and so many ways of doing this. They may be deep in debt, they may have other problems, but it's not the sweat of the brow issues as it was in previous generations. Because there was a change, you see. There was a change from chapter 3 to chapter 5. Now getting back to the conclusion of the matter. When he gives this and we learn that you will work, we need to see that part of it. Not just the sweat of the brow, but that you will eat from the produce of the ground. The object lesson besides that cursing that we would take all of these years later is that you work. You say, well, then you work, then that's the command. But you do because you work for your family. Now we get the picture? We're not working for society. We're not working for the community. We're not working for the government. It may seem like that, but we are to be working for our family's sake. But what point? Oh, well, we provide, yes. But what else do we learn? What other lesson? That we show the rest of society what it means to work unto the Lord. What it means to work as commanded by the Lord, because we give Him the respect and homage that He deserves. So the Christian homes should influence society in regards to even their occupation. Now you would segue into that in choosing things that are honorable before Him and just. And we won't go through all of that, but things that would provide for our families that are respectable. And that we administer those and do those as Christians, showing the world that we are indeed His. That we owe everything to Him. That we show others the way. It's like the old adage, whoever coined it, that you can give a man a fish today, but if you give a man the tools to go catch that fish, he can eat for life, can't he? There's other ways of putting that, but you see my point. You teach a man how to work, then he can do what God would provide, have him to do. Now do you see the godly pattern? It's not that we neglect the poor. James 1:27 tells us very plainly that the pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is to take care of, that's the visit part, to provide for the necessity of the widows and the orphans, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And we look at that and we say the widows and orphans, what's the point? Because they're the vulnerable. They're the ones that are neglected. They're not the ones who can do for themselves. He didn't say so that you can provide for those who can do. The Proverbs has a lot to say about the lazy man. So we learn that. Number two, the Christian home is the one who should be influencing society by showing the differences in a real education, because it's one that's bound upon God's Word. The Christian home will teach the children as well as they will demonstrate themselves in their workplace that they have been educated by God first and foremost. You see, we've got it upside down. We live in an age in which education may mean everything. Education may mean the difference between a job or not in some cases. Education is lauded and praised for itself alone. There are people who perpetually are educated, perpetually studying, getting this, that, and the other in regards to degrees to no end. And others may get them to an end, but it becomes the end, not for the provision for the means, but rather end of itself. And so therefore, someone will be given accolades and they will go through history and they will say, well, look at me and who I am. They're hopeful at the retirement that they will be honored and respected for that. And I'm not arguing against education. I'm not an education basher because I believe strongly in education. But it must be grounded firmly and deeply in the Christian ethics first and foremost. And that does not mean that I said that every child needs to be in a quote-unquote Christian school. Not saying that. Not arguing that. Because again, what have I been teaching? It's not the school, it's the home that's responsible. So whatever happens, the society needs to see my children and they need to see me in that light. Have they been able to do that? Maybe not. Maybe not always, in fact, indeed. It's a very sad commentary on us. See, I'm not talking of the world. They're going to do what they will. They're not going to be neglectful. We understand the worse that the society gets, the worse that the society gets. And that's already started at the home and the breakdown of the home, etc. I'm not going to solve that. I can't fix the world's problems anyway, and it's never going to happen. Do not ever imagine that you're going to solve it. And you're not going to do it through some collective, and it ain't going to be done through some organization nor government. Each person's going to decide in their place and in their home, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, Joshua 24 and verse 15. And that means a whole lot. That means a great deal. Luke 2:52. Luke 2:52. How would that inform me? Well, just a little bit of background. If you want to see the most that you can of Jesus before his ministry, Luke's going to tell you the most. Because Luke will not only get you through into his birth, but he'll carry you up to the 12th year. Now, that doesn't mean you get a glimpse of every day or life, but you get a picture of what it would have been like to be him, so to speak, and to be in his household in that period of time leading up to his 12th year. And then he still has much more to go before he'll begin his ministry. But notice what verse 52 tells us. And this is when they come back and find him with the rabbis, the teachers of the temple. And they're amazed at what he knows. And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Now we read that. Isn't that nice? Guys, we're learning something here. You know, we talked about this morning what we can learn about from Jesus about temptation, right? But do you realize what else we need to learn here? It's not just as 12-year-olds. And yes, that would be true. But for parents mostly, is to strive to teach our children in such a way that they will grow in stature and in wisdom. When it says Jesus increased in wisdom and stature, are we to just believe that since he is the Son of God already and still will be 100% though he is a child, a male, that he just come by that naturally, necessarily? Of course he could do that. The average 12-year-old didn't have the advantages he had. Guys, we're missing it altogether if we don't understand that Jesus came as a full man. And he experienced everything, as we said this morning from Philippians chapter 2, but without sin as we. And he had parents. And they were relatively impoverished parents that lived in a very poor society, a poor area, actually, of Judaism, within a poor place among the whole Roman Empire. And it says he increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Now, he had a part to play in that. I do not doubt that. But let us not neglect to see Joseph and Mary's efforts in that regard. They did not make him the Son of God, but they helped mold and shape him in his youth. In the processes, he was taught. Did he have greater wisdom? He paid more attention. There's no doubt about that. Did he understand things that others? Yes. But again, it goes back to attentiveness and direction. And I want to impress upon you the fact that we see the difference in education in the home of this family through Jesus, through the lens of Jesus. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy 6, a passage I think we should be very familiar with, that likewise is repeated again in chapter 11. Now remember, this is the second generation. This is the generation that will be allowed to go into the land of Canaan. The first, they're already on the way out. In fact, they're pretty much, these are just days and weeks, months before they go in. So the first generation were not being told this, but it was the second generation. Notice that. They thought they were worthy. And then they thought that, wait a minute, we can't do it, the first generation. So they wouldn't go, and God says, no, you're going to languish and die in the wilderness, and they did. But here's what God had to say to that second generation before they went into the land. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 7. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. What shall they? Back to verse 1. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess, so that you and your sons and your grandsons might fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, and that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of our fathers, of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. And hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. Then he says, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and you shall, when you walk in the way, do the same, and you shall, when you lie down and when you rise up. What is he telling? What is he telling them? Your primary responsibility isn't to go in and conquer the land. Isn't to go in and start cultivating the soil and becoming farmers and getting into other crafts and developing cities and making things. That will happen eventually, of course. It isn't just to go sit down because you've got a land that flows with milk and honey. And yes, they would be able to reap the benefits of the produce of that land even without their working for them in that generation. That isn't what he says. Your job to make sure that you're instructing your children all the time, at every waking moment. Every waking moment. Now, dear friends, that is a hard lesson to hear for me. For me. Not from me. For me. Because I've not always done that. Sadly. But dear friends, you want to know where this society has gone? That's why. Society has ended up where it's at because of that. This should have been really the first point, because it's a primary lesson. A primary lesson by itself is that we have not taken our responsibility for primary spiritual education of our children. We said, oh, if we care and we're interested in these things, We need to cultivate them in their things that they know well or able to do well academically and lead them into an education. If they're good in sports, we want to do that just in case they get a scholarship at some prestigious school. Let us get them molded and cultivated, they say. Let us get them ready for the job and for the family. Let us get them ready for those sorts of things. And that's just with morally based families generally, not even just Christian homes. And what about the souls that could care less and have been neglectful? And the single parent families and all of those things that are great tragedies, the divorce rates that we have, on and on and on. I could go and you know. What about us? Obviously, we've not done very well. We may be in a minority as far as the people of this world, but it doesn't change the fact that we have failed. And many generations, unfortunately, have not paid attention to this. We thought they would get it enough if we brought them to the houses of worship. All if they're in those classrooms, because that's just like being in a classroom at school, right? Not necessarily so. Teachers may not be well-equipped. They may be ill-equipped. They may not care much. They may just be there for babysitting purposes. They may learn a few things. They may not. And if they do learn well, great. But is that enough? Is that enough? You see, the church isn't does not have the responsibility to teach my children. Let's make it clear. The church does not have the responsibility to train my children. They can take a part in that. They can help nurture that. They can encourage that. The elders, or the shepherds of the flock are not accountable and responsible. They're responsible for the souls. They're responsible to the extent that they have to teach those parents to do well and to encourage that and admonish that. But the Christian home, the parents, are the main line of responsibility and accountability. And again, that phrase that we just saw in verse 7 of Deuteronomy 6 is repeated in chapter 11 and verse 19. You see, dear friends, we got to pay attention. Look at Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 11. First of all, in verse 1, my son, do not forget the teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Now he says in verse 11, my son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe his reproof. You see, there's a discipline from the Lord, but how do we get there? Does the Lord just come down and say, now, bend over, Jerry. It's time. Now the word discipline, to understand it properly, is training and teaching. It would command, it's a broad word in which it commands of necessity corporal punishment at times, but it also of necessity commands for teaching and instruction. So it's a very broad term that it's inclusive to all things. The Lord chastens us or disciplines us, as Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5 says. And here he says the Lord, he teaches us. He does it primarily through his word. We understand that. But how is it going to get from the pages of our Bibles to the lips of our children or to the hearts of our children? It's got to be taught. It don't happen by osmosis. And it don't just because you bring them into the assembly. As most young children are, as I was, I can just imagine what they hear from me most of the time would be much what you would hear from the peanuts, the womp, 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 the adults in the audience. And I understand that. I was a kid once, right? So for the hour that we spend here or the 2 hours we spend, they're not. They get 40, 45 minutes in a classroom. Of course, we hope that's not the adult equivalent of the womp. But we understand that is limited experience, isn't it? That's why we take every advantage. We should. And until they get to adulthood and start being able to understand me, the question will be, will they listen? I remember I was a teenager. The blank stare on your face. I don't know how many sermons I heard that I didn't hear a thing. It's easy to tune out. I don't need extra distractions. But I know this much, that if we're doing the job that we're supposed to in the home, we will succeed. We will succeed in grounding the things that are necessary for that next generation even, and including ourselves, to have an impression upon society to whatever extent that we can. We can find the peace of mind and understanding that we, at the least, as Joshua says, will serve the Lord, and we can be satisfied in that. We can find peace in that. Though everything around us is nothing but turmoil and strife and tension and trouble and all kinds of hatred and enmity, we can build that shelter in our own home of peace. And Proverbs 22 and verse 15. Proverbs 22 and verse 15. We cannot neglect our responsibilities, even as I stated earlier, even in the corporate way. For foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, and the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. Dear friends, I don't know how many times I've read that and not even stopped to think about it. It isn't that I just discovered it, by the way, but I'm going to tell you just plainly here. He's not just saying, whip your child. He's saying, if you want your child to turn out well, you will make sure that he does exactly what you expect. That's another problem, of course. We bought into the psychobabble of our age. We stroke them. It's not that we don't need to measure corporal punishment. That's not the point. Because we're not to be harsh. Ephesians 6 and verse 4 says that very plainly. We'll get to that in another lesson soon. But the fact of the matter is, we cannot neglect this admonition right here and expect any good to come of it. And don't be shocked when they don't turn out to do even what you do, whatever that is that's good. Don't be shocked when they go out and they do their own thing, and their own thing doesn't have anything to do with godly activity. Don't be shocked when they end up in relationships that become ruined and destroyed. Don't be shocked when they care nothing for God, and don't be surprised when the pews are empty. The older set, and even I at this point, can tell you the diminishing returns of just simply bringing your children to church. Because empty pews are all over the world, all over the country in particular. They're everywhere. The next generation, they're nowhere to be found. It isn't just because all of them have moved to another locale. They just simply are not there. They're done with it all. They're finished. And that was incremental. It's happened over the years. It's happened at different times, but it's happened in mass in our country primarily since the 1960s. And it's not societal. It has everything to do with the home. And it has everything to do with this rod of discipline. The Dr. Spocks of the world did his job and did them well, didn't they? And we bought into it because we were already fat and healthy, had all that we wanted and all that we would need, and we were distracted by our own desires and our own pleasures and our own vacations and our own wants, and we didn't really have any needs at all, and we couldn't learn contentment even at the first, as Paul had learned it from Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 12 or 11. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Do not forget that. And finally, Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 5. And the lesson will be yours. A fool rejects his father's discipline, but he who regards reproof is sensible. Let that be a lesson to you children who are old enough to hear me, if you will listen and understand. A fool rejects his father's discipline, but he who regards reproof is sensible. And I've already stated, and we'll pick up with that next time, in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Because we got a few more points to make. This is a two-parter because, again, well, partly because I think it's very important, and the various points that I've made are very important to stress. And we may not truly get it. You may disagree with me. But I can tell you, it's right here. And I can tell you right now, this is why we've experienced what we've had. We can just shake our heads. We can look at one another and feel disgust. We can feel the pain and suffering we may lament things, and we can just look at, and we can broad brush, and we can look at society and all of that. But I'll tell you what, we're looking into a blank mirror, a mirror that you can't even see because you're not looking back into yourself. It's not about this. It's not about out there. You might as well just look into the sky because that's all that matters. You got to look here. You got to look here. And you got to ask yourself, what will you do? What will you do to change anything? So at the best, your family is everything that it can be. So that when society is at its lowest ebb, that someone can look at you or your children or your wife or your husband and say, I want what they've got. I want what they have. Because what I got is a ruin, a disgrace, and a mess. And I want things changed. I see the peace. They don't see peace. They see the sum of the same. You don't look any different than your neighbor, and neither do I. My house looks the same as the guys across the street. I walk out it just like they do. I've got cars, maybe not as nice as theirs, but it doesn't really matter. I got cars that drives. I come out dressed, and I don't look emaciated. I look like I've eaten a little bit, haven't I? I look like I'm well. I'm out. I got family. I got friends that come. I don't look any different than they. See, that's the world we have grown up in and been willing to accept. We've not looked for the peculiar spirit that God wants us to be. And so may we change our hearts and desire, our heart's desire, and start focusing on what makes us uniquely children of God. Just as we're studying in Acts, what makes us uniquely the church as opposed to just a religious institution that happens to have a building in this community. So everybody else has one too. Go right down the street. We'll find a few. Some of them even meeting this evening. Why are we different? We need to learn that, just as we need to learn about our families, and we need to be unique. May you consider these things. If you're here this evening, you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. May I encourage that tonight.